vivo qualitative data analysis software empowers researchers around the world to discover rich insights within their qualitative data. This podcast gives you unique insights into the methods, the processes, and the passions of researchers. Welcome to the InVivo podcast, Between the Data.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Stacey Penna, the Engagement and Enablement Director at LumaVero. Today's podcast is with Dr. Maria Lehman, Professor of Qualitative Research Methods at the University of Northern Colorado. We'll be discussing her work on culturally responsive qualitative research based on her book, Ethics in Social Science Research, Becoming Culturally Responsive. So welcome, Maria. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, I really appreciate the invitation. And I always like to do stuff with, let's see, is it pronounced LumaVero now?
LumaVero, yep.
Yeah, because they do so much support for my students. Particularly, we have InVivo in our consulting lab, and they've helped people out in the middle of the night during spring break. So thank you so much. So,
oh, good. I'm glad. How did you become interested in studying culturally responsive research?
Yeah. You know, if I would think back to my first interest in it, I was a pre-K teacher in the field for about 10 years. And back in the day, when they would train you about children, it was often about discrete identity, almost like this is what you should think about for boys. This is what you should think about for girls. And then, of course, as soon as you get into practice, you realize it's much more intersectional than that. Mm-hmm. And then the field, of course, had been updating that. And they had this idea of the new sociology of childhood. And they really started to look at what they looked at as intersections or the nexus of these identities crossing. And we see that across all disciplines now in intersectionality, of course, that people will be very familiar with. But that's more coming from the child area. So that was really my applied experience. Then if you want to go way back for myself, I hold a lot of dominant privileged identities. I'm a woman. I'm cishet. I'm very firmly middle class. Sometimes I've been poor middle class, but it's for highly educated reasons. Like my dad was a professor. And so when he was getting his last degree, we were certainly poor, but you know, it was just a period of time, myself with education, that kind of thing. So I've always been in these very dominant identity areas, but simultaneously I'm Mennonite. And so you don't look at me and say, oh, she's a Mennonite. I don't wear covering or look like I'm Amish or anything like that. But I certainly have lots of family members that do. I'm considered progressive Mennonite. But because of that, that identity is very marginalized identity because we're pacifists. And so whenever I go into something, I'm always thinking about students in my room that I'm teaching that cover or have these other kinds of religious identities, or maybe they're an atheist, which is an identity that mainstream US is very uncomfortable with. And so it's kind of these different aspects of who I am that really made me think about when I teach qualitative research, how can we be the most culture responsive possible, because I'm just convinced that that's when you're going to get your most authentic, rich information. And also it's just a moral and ethical responsibility on our part. We say, oh, I'm going to just say to someone, I'm going to interview you. But we need to stop and think about the audacity to tell someone, I'm going to interview you, record this. I might put your voice on the internet for the whole world. I'm going to try and protect your identity, but maybe someone would know, or maybe they want to be identified. And so we need to treat it as the very sacred act it is.
What is culturally responsive research?
Well, I think the first thing that's really important to acknowledge is that the field of education has been doing culturally responsive, also sometimes called culturally competent pedagogy or education for some time now. And since I have education degrees, I've always been firmly embedded in following that. They really developed out of, if you think of several decades ago, out of multicultural understandings. And now we think of it as much more diverse and many, many identities. Race and ethnicity, of course, is one of the really important ones, but we think of lots of identities such as sexual orientation, gender, class. And so what this does then is when I was examining the respect that's needed within this, I kept thinking, oh, this should be pulled over to research. And so myself and others, Sage has a wonderful book on intersectional qualitative research, have been bringing this to research directly qualitative researchers. And I would argue all researchers would do better, more respectful and authentic research if they thought about culturally responsive aspects of this. And we do see it in medical and quantitative psychological research, where they're looking at things like cultural humility, cultural competence, because they know that when they engage with a procedure with someone, for example, and if they don't understand the person's cultural needs or open up a space where the person can express that, that the medical outcomes obviously aren't nearly as beneficial for anybody. So within that context, when I think about it within research, one of the huge pieces that comes first that we often rush is, who am I as the researcher? So if I don't understand my own identity as a researcher, then how am I going to understand someone else's identity? So I'm trying to think about, what are my major identities? What did people try and teach me from my cultural background that I either agree with now or I don't? Even when we don't agree with it, it comes along with us wherever we go, whether we practice that now or not. And then think about, how might this be similar or dissimilar to the culture that I want to study? The more dissimilar it is, the more you're going to want to engage with leaders and members in that community to make sure that you're doing the most respectful thing possible. And sometimes you might even realize, you know, I'm really not the right fit for this research. And maybe you'll help someone else do it and be more of a support for them. So I would really say that if we wanted to define it more succinctly, it's a process and an outcome where you're thinking about both your own identities and your own cultures, and also trying to be responsive to those of the research participants that you're potentially inviting to join your study.
Great. Thank you. That's excellent. Why are the tenets of culturally responsive research important?
Okay.
And maybe what they are.
Yeah. And so for my own work, I'm trying to take different articles I've had and a text I had on culturally responsive research ethics, and I'm trying to move it into an introductory text. And within that text, obviously I said I hold dominant identities and subordinate identities. I'm inviting different students that have different identities to contribute text boxes and different perspectives. Some of the chapters will have different authors who don't necessarily even agree, because there's not always agreement on these types of things, because that's one of the super cool things about culture. It has space for disagreement, but it is an introductory text. And so I'll do, how do you do interviews? How do you do observations? And so then within that, I'm also trying to talk about how to be a culturally responsive researcher. So I thought, I really need to kind of distill this down at an introductory level, get those resources into people's hands so they can go read more about it if they want. And so I decided to propose tenets. Now, I framed the tenets that you might want to add to those or reframe them, or maybe one doesn't work as well for you as someone else. And so they could be said to be thinking about intersectionality, which I already discussed, thinking about the sacredness of the story. And I have some really powerful pieces from people talking about what sacred story means, because I think in the really fast moving US culture kind of context, you know, it's okay to just flame someone's story or just move through a story or just ask for a story. And so we need to think about what are we really doing there? I also want us to look at whiteness, because so many of our textbooks are very dominant white perspectives. We often have white researchers that we're teaching. And so we need to take a critical look at whiteness, and also people that aren't white can use critical whiteness when they're trying to think about how to change and upend systemic white racism. This is a piece that's quite helpful too. And then just the idea of respect too.
Are there qualities you need to be a culturally responsive researcher?
Well, something that I did actually with my kids during COVID, I kept making cards that I would lay out of all the different characteristics that I thought a qualitative researcher should ideally have when I was trying to propose the request to write this book. And so I had probably 30 or 40, and I'd lay them out and I'd say, which ones of these are actually parts of others? Because, you know, you can't present 30 or 40 things to people unless it's in a, I don't know, like a word cloud or something like that. It's too confusing. And so I was able to narrow it down eventually. And just because of the length of a book, I think I only cover maybe 8 or so. And then I think when I say that it's for a qualitative researcher in the book, really all sorts of researchers would benefit from these kinds of things. But just for example, one that we often look at is curiosity. So any kind of researcher would be curious. And I think that didn't make the cut to the final book, though. But for example, I decided to use the word intrepid because I was thinking about, if you want to be culturally responsive, there's this idea where white people like myself want to be very nice. So we've seen that in the popular literature, nice white. And so we become frozen, where we're really concerned about not being humiliated or hurting someone's feelings or not being seen as an ally because we're going to say something wrong. And so we have to have a sense of bravery where we're willing to try something and hear that we weren't doing what someone would have liked. So it's a very interesting combination almost of, can you listen? So it's okay to just hear something and think, I'm not sure I either understand that or I agree with that. And just to make space to try and listen, hold that and be in a learning position, but also know when you have the power in the space, you need to use it and step out and say, this is not appropriate. And so how much can we use the research that we're doing to support people in making space in spaces like higher education? So I often say, and I've heard it in the popular literature too, look around the room you're in. This is straight from my mom. Does someone there not feel welcome? Maybe there's your only people there like you. Why is that? How did you get there? And then try and make spaces that people feel authentically welcome, that they can thrive. Or if they're not there, why aren't they there? And figure out ways that they can join you. So this is kind of a, how do you hold when not to talk, when to talk?
This podcast is sponsored by Lumavero, developers of Invivo and other software designed by and for data experts to illuminate powerful new insights that help customers make decisions with confidence. If you're looking for a better way to collaborate and share Invivo projects with your colleagues or team, try using Invivo Collaboration Cloud with the 14-day trial.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I like that description of what you just described your mom telling you, because I think a lot of times we get so wrapped up in ourselves, right? And what we're feeling in the space, we don't look at how others are feeling in it too.
Yeah. And I'm around, my children are adolescents. And so you can see it in them so clearly. And we forget anytime we're in a new situation or feel thrown off, we do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just not as often as a younger person might.
Or we can hide it a little better. Yes, we've learned to hide it.
Yeah.
So one thing I found really interesting that you mentioned joy and humility as important qualities. So how do these mix with the research qualities of rigor and validity?
Okay. And let's talk about joy first. I think that is often one that people love, but also are surprised by. And so I think this goes back to the idea of when you're getting your PhD, I'm sure you had the same thing where your faculty will say, you know, you better research something you like that you can live with. You're going to live with it for about 10 years. So we're looking for something authentic interest. And so that's where I get this idea of joy. And then joy does not imply that everything's good. Like you're just going to try and understand good things. In order for us to understand joy, we have to understand pain. The two go together. So when you get that full sense where joy springs up, it's often after a time of sadness. And you can see this repeated over and over through different philosophical beliefs, religious beliefs, where they talk about, you know, that, you know, joy comes in the morning type idea. And so for my own self, it's quite easy because I research children. And if you don't find joy in children, you should not research them. So if children are someone that irritate you, that kind of thing, and certainly they can be irritating. I often say it's actually the grownups around them that are being irritating, not the kids. you shouldn't research them. And so there's going to be times where it's very tough to research children. It's been made tougher and tougher to even access them. And then they can have some really difficult things going on in their lives that can make you really feel distraught. But at the same time, how do you find the joy in that? And so what that does is if you're going to be a culturally responsive researcher, particularly if you hold dominant identities that society has really marginalized, made incredibly difficult. So let's take an African-American researcher over their career. How do they stay renewed? And so joy is one of the ways that we can stay renewed. As long as we can go back, it's like when I go back in the classroom, one of my absolute favorite things is to work with my doctoral students. I love to talk about their research. And so as long as you have that joy in your research, it'll be self-renewing. Mm-hmm. So then the other piece is the humility. And I was so amazed and pleased to see humility coming out of the psychologies. I'm sure it's been well over a decade now, talking about how can we be culturally humble? But I was disconcerted that we did that typical secular thing where we just picked up as though we invented it, where religion and philosophy has been looking at that for hundreds of years. And so I just had an article come out with three former students of mine where we looked at cultural humility. And of course, there's never enough room in an article, a little bit about how do Muslims, how do Hindus, how do atheists, my own background, Mennonite, humility is such a big deal that I would often joke that we're actually proud of how humble we are. So, and I know there's a lot of Protestant Catholic type where it's like, you need to be humble. That's going to resonate with a lot of people. But I know I had an uncle that said my grandpa pulled him aside once when he won a race and said, I thought maybe you enjoyed that too much. So that would have been part of our schooling. Like, you know, you must be really humble. And I know I won't quote it right, but my son listens to Kendrick Lamar, the great rapper, of course, and he has that lovely line, sit down, be humble. And so it's that kind of idea. Anyway, so if we can bring that humility in as a researcher, obviously we're researching it because we want to learn. So instead of coming in from an expert perspective, coming in from the humility perspective, I think it makes our research much more rigorous and much more valid. And I'll give a quick example. I usually prefer to give examples when I mess up, but they're really long. But this is just a classic example. Way back in the day, we started getting lots of Muslims from the Horn of Africa through a refugee amnesty program. And so I consulted on a project where we didn't do our due diligence right ahead of time. Now, I was familiar with this from my parents' backgrounds, and they didn't realize that you would many times not do cross-gender research. And so things were happening where a male researcher would keep putting out their hand to shake a woman's hand, that kind of thing. And so we quickly said, let's resort this around, start meeting with the community elders, find out what's the most appropriate way to do the research. And, you know, we found out you could do cross-gender research under certain circumstances and protocols, and have had a really thriving set of research there, I think. But it's just those little things, just checking quickly to find out what kind of norms might be different. And then if you're going to engage on the research, it would be a much more in-depth process with the community leaders. And, you know, if you wanted, let's say you want to interview youth from the Horn of Africa, what do the youth think about it? Because they might have a different expectation than their elders. So all this, I think, comes back to something that I've seen a little bit of discussion about called slow research, which is so hard because we need to finish our programs. We need to do the grant. We need to get tenure. We want a promotion. But the more the field could slow down to and be thoughtful, obviously, the more authentic it will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like your time is a lot of like that building that trust too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And trust is one of the constructs I go over in the intro text too. It's just so huge. And there's been a lot of qualitative methodologists before me that have really looked at that. People like Carolyn Ellis, for example. And she's so amazing of telling really difficult things that she did that she, I'm sure, won't do again. But she's willing to tell you about that so you can learn from it.
Mm-hmm. Are there common research methods used when conducting culturally responsive research?
Yes, definitely. The first is to try and get a group of your peers that are interested in similar type things. And so when we think about a member check, this is almost like a very extensive peer check where you're constantly able to go and talk to them and say, oh my goodness, I felt so humiliated today. I did this, or I did nothing and I don't know what I should do next. And so you have a group that's willing to process these kinds of things with you, things about your identity, things about next steps. And in different places in the literature, you can find that written out too. I know I won't get the cite off the top of my head, but I think the one is called a critical friends group. And unfortunately, I can't get the author. But the other idea too then is to form a group like that, but it's with people from the group that you want to do the research with. So they're consulting with you. And this has been an idea out of participatory action research for a long time, where you would have this group of experts in the field that would be consulting with you, because our training and our tendency is often to go and consult with our faculty and our experts on campus, which we should. I mean, they obviously have an expertise, but it's with talking to the people in the field. Culturally responsive research says that you're going to really learn the more relational aspect and be very up to date. So for example, I'm an expert in pre-K. Well, I haven't taught in that area for 23 years. You see what I mean? Now, I'm certainly around kids all the time, but that's a very different thing than being in the trenches. I remember what that was like, but it's probably quite different by now, I'm sure. I know it is. I know it is. And then another idea that I think is really important is when you do consent, instead of doing kind of this one-off, I have consent. And this is some work that different people like Ellis did, for example, and I've done with some of my colleagues like Katrina Rodriguez, to have it be a whole process throughout where you check back in and you're not trying to do something laborious, like, do you still want to be in the study and go on and on? But you're checking back in a thoughtful way if the person is experiencing the study in the way you hope that they are, What could you do to make it a better experience and improve it? And then for myself as a methodologist, even when we're leaving the field, the last part of the kind of closing interview is saying, is there anything that was confusing to you that we could change for future people? Is there anything that you didn't understand or that I should have done differently? And so we're always kind of checking those things relationally for methodology. And then once you establish this trusting kind of relationship, you can also take iterations of your work back for people to look at. And then you can even write and publish with them, depending on what the kind of work is. Some research participants won't have any interest in that, or there's too much change. So some of this research could take a couple years and the people in the environment change who they are, perhaps. But then I've definitely, with some of my students, had research participants go through the hallway with them and publish work. So it can be a pretty incredible experience.
We'll take a quick break from the episode. You can find Dr. Lehman's book, Ethics and Social Science Research, Becoming Culturally Responsive, on Sage Publications' website. A couple of years ago, we did a webinar series on culturally responsive research. So we'll tag that in when we do a blog about this podcast. But some of the presentations were really quite incredible and gave a lot of information on how to do the research in communities.
I've seen some of those. And one thing I skipped here is the way you collect the data could be quite different too.
Right.
And you can ask the people how they'd like the data to be collected. And so there's many, many different ways. But at the most simplistic level, you're asking people or hanging out with people about the idea of interest, and you're trying to ask them in the way that they would find most culturally appropriate and relevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the second half of your book, you have examples of working with vulnerable populations, for example, children, the homeless, immigrants, and more. What is some advice you have in regards to working with vulnerable populations?
Okay. And I really tried to draw on Liam Puntong's work, and that's a SAGE author also. Her work is so incredible. And what she was looking at, it's kind of a hard balance where when you talk about an identity, you risk being essentialist. So you're saying like all people in that area are like this. We're not trying to do that. But on the other hand, how do you talk about particular identities? And so the second half of the book, I talked about any identity that myself or my major students had done a lot of research in the area. So for example, one of them is children, because that's one of my areas. We know that the government protects certain populations for very important reasons. Children, for example, terrible things have happened to them. But then what can happen is the university almost becomes too paternalistic. And sometimes it has a feeling to me that the university is trying to make sure nothing litigious could happen with them. Institutions too, I should say, any kind of research institution like a hospital. And so, for example, I had a colleague that had a grant to do research with LGBTQ plus adults. The adults were still students at universities, and my colleague was not able to get an IRB approval because they were concerned that even though the adults were out, that since they were students, somehow something could happen. And so what happens then is you had this incredible opportunity. He was going to look at very rural populations to understand a rural aspect of LGBTQ plus young adults' experiences, and it didn't happen. And so the most important thing I find is to understand that even if you're vulnerable, that's not an essential identity. You're also capable and competent. So children are capable, competent, and vulnerable simultaneously. The chapter on homeless. So let's say you're homeless. All of us are, knock on wood, but a tragedy and our friend's couches away from being homeless. And so homeless people are also comprised of people with PhDs, educators, and people who have held high level positions. So you might still be the head of a family, but also be homeless. So we don't assume when someone's in a homeless state that they now are completely vulnerable and have no capabilities or competencies. I mean, we're having a lovely snow here this morning, and my ability to take care of myself if I had to be on the street this evening would be very low compared to someone that's homeless currently that's been doing that. And so what I try and do in all those chapters is make that a more complex understanding that people can hold these identities at the same time while respecting that obviously very awful things have happened to these groups and the reason for the vulnerable statuses. Statuses, is that a word?
Sure.
Status.
So thank you for sharing that. And then what's next for you?
Oh, so let's talk about this book I'm trying to write on introduction to qualitative research. I'm trying to include many different identities that have really had a lot of misunderstanding and egregious things happen to them in research. So I'm able to pair looking at Indigenous people in research with the chapter that we many times would have called artifact collection. And I'm using an Indigenous researcher who says that he really dislikes the word artifact. For many natives, from his perspective, it feels like this idea where we come and we take something from the native culture, we put it in a museum because the culture was going to disappear, but it didn't. They're here. And so I've chosen to switch that word to saying material data. Mm. And so how can we pick up material data and look at that? And so within that, I'm trying to have every chapter have several people that hold that identity, be an identity reader for the chapter and give me feedback. So I've had one good round of feedback from a native USA scholar, and I'm trying to get some other rounds, and then also have Indigenous people scholars write text box within the chapter. And then, of course, I review the general literature because I don't hold that identity. I hold a colonizing identity. And so within each chapter, I'm trying to express these voices. And I kept thinking, can I get a chapter on religion, non-religious, and spiritual? And I thought, I don't know if I'll have room. And I did find one. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be some different voices like mine that are often ones that we don't think about as much in higher ed and research. So I'm pretty excited about it. But fundamentally, it is an introductory text. So it's culturally an introduction to qualitative research, like culturally responsive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Can't wait to read it.
Yeah, me too. I need to finish half a chapter, I guess.
My last question is, what's one piece of advice you would give researchers on becoming culturally responsive?
Okay, first off, emphasizing the becoming. So give yourself a lot of space and grace. This is a lifelong process. Every semester I do something or many things that I think, oh my goodness. And so then I have to sit with that and process and continue to work on that. This is a lifelong process. And then think about, what's the best way for you to think through your identity? Are you someone that likes to journal in longhand? Do you like to dictate to your computer or type, or is it better to process with friends over coffee? And set up these structures that you'll be processing this before you get in the middle of a situation that's very difficult for you. Try and set it up ahead of time. And then think through as strategically and creatively as you can how you can start to create networks as you move towards your first really big project, which of course will be your dissertation. So you don't want to be doing that, dream that at the same time. You want to have set the ground that you can be moving in to have the most authentic, culturally responsive experience that you can. And then be ready. The huge fun of the field is there's going to be a lot of times where stuff just absolutely does not go the way you think it is. And again, that's where this idea of grace, give yourself some grace that we're always learning.
I like that. That's very good advice. So thank you, Maria, for talking with us, and thanks for those tuning in. Listeners, if you learn more about culturally responsive research, we'd appreciate your support by rating and subscribing to the NVIVO podcast. This helps us to share these amazing narratives with the research community. So thank you, Maria.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for Between the Data. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more about NVIVO podcasts and community events, please visit go.envivobyqsr.com/community or email me, Stacy Penna, at s.penna, P-E-N-N-A, @qsrinternational.com.